Fragment 30. Sadly, or perhaps not, I recognize that I have an arid heart. An adjective matters more to me than the real weeping of a human soul. But sometimes I'm different. Sometimes I have the warm tears of those who don't have, and never had, a mother. And the eyes that burn with these dead tears burn inside my heart. I don't remember my mother. She died when I was 1 year old. My distracted and callous sensibility comes from the lack of that warmth and from my useless longing after kisses I don't remember. I'm artificial. It was always against strange breasts that I woke up, cuddled as if by proxy. It's my longing for whom I might have been that distracts and torments me. Who would I be now if I'd received the affection that comes from the womb and is placed, through kisses, on a baby's face? Perhaps my regret for having never been a son plays a large role in my emotional indifference. Whoever held me as a child against her face couldn't hold me against her heart. Only she who was far away in a tomb could have done that. She who would have belonged to me had fate willed it. They told me later that my mother was pretty, and they say that, when they told me, I made no comment. I was already fit in body and soul, but ignorant about emotions and people's speech was not yet news from other hard-to-imagine pages. My father, who lived far away, killed himself when I was 3, and so I never met him. I still don't know why he lived far away. I never cared to find out. I remember his death as a grave silence during the first meals we ate after learning about it. I remember that the others would occasionally look at me and I would look back, dumbly comprehending. Then I'd eat with more concentration, since they might, when I wasn't looking, still be looking at me. I'm all of these things, like it or not, in the confused depths of my fatal sensibility. Every few months or so, I sit down and write a letter to Pessoa. Fernando Pessoa, the Portuguese poet and writer. I usually write these letters in longhand on A4 sheets of paper, the same cheap printer paper that I fold over and staple so as to make a kind of A5 booklet or pad on which to take notes or sketch out ideas when talking with clients. Like a child clinging to the idea of Santa Claus long after schoolyard whispers have shattered this illusion, I not only write, but also send each letter to the postal address where Pessoa spent the final 15 years of his life before dying at the age of 47 with cirrhosis of the liver, most likely due to alcoholism. Hope I have is that some part of that writer, perhaps the ghost rumored to haunt the cultural center which now stands in the same building where he once ate, slept, and penned his fragmented musings all those years ago, might intercept my written communication before it is consigned to the dustbin or dead letters drawer by whoever opens the post at 16 to 18 Rua Coelho da Rocha in Lisbon. I am still waiting to get a letter back from my friend Fernando Pessoa. Like certain letters I would love to read from the still living phantoms who now populate my life, I suspect I may need to become a kind of ghost myself in order to receive his, as well as their, replies. Here's my most recent missive to FP, vaguely connected to the idea of having an arid heart, which he refers to in fragment 30 of the Book of Disquiet, translated by Richard Zenith in 1991. Sadly, or perhaps not, he writes here, I recognize that I have an arid heart. An adjective matters more to me than the real weeping of a human soul. But sometimes, I'm different. Hey, FP. I've decided to go with FP for now, as Fernando only cues those blasted Swedes and their blasted earworms, which have nothing to do with you. Can you hear the drums, Fernando? Pessoa resonates in that you are archetypally Pessoan, a person, or at least a particular kind of person, the melancholic Enneagram 4. But whereas Fernando feels too informal for our connection, cutesy almost, I would say, Pessoa puts a distance between us, which I don't really care for either. So why has the word blasted appeared twice in the previous sentence, FP? Maybe some kind of etymological mythos rumbling from the depths of the psychic underworld. Let's see, okay. Here's the reading from the online etymology dictionary. Blasted, adjective. Stricken by malignant forces, natural or supernatural, cursed, blighted. Balefully breathe upon, causing to wither or to blight. Also, cursed, damned. The meaning drunk or stoned dates from 1972, perhaps from the condition of one so affected, but also with the idea of the verb blast, to smoke marijuana, attested from 1959. Very appropriate, I think, as you'll soon come to see. It's been 6 months since I last wrote to you, my friend. A long, wet, dark, and unfriendly kind of winter, made tolerable only by escaping each evening into the arms of my green girlfriend, as I like to call her. I've shied away so far from becoming an alcoholic, but a few years ago, I thought I might throw in my lot, if you like, with cannabis instead, and started vaping it in the evenings. As you can probably tell, I am somewhat late to the party when it comes to cannabis. And I'm really not sure what it's done to my brainware in the interim, most likely fucked it up in some shape or form, as you seem to have fucked up your liver with drink. But let's say I have now seen, somewhat, the error of my ways and am ready to repent. Well, not repent exactly, but rather attempt to get through life on the whole without the green one by my side. I'm missing her. Also experiencing a kind of ongoing and unrelenting form of anhedonia, which only accentuates my already arid heart, to use that lovely phrase, from you. I think my green girlfriend softened my arid heart, as sometimes a partner with different traits than us can offset those more spiky aspects of our nature. Although, to be fair, I suspect that if you scrape away at the silvery sheen of the human heart, the way one might a lottery scratch card, there would be very few prizes revealed beneath the metallic-looking foil. Perhaps a better term for an arid heart might be that of a self-serving heart. Every human creature, as far as I can tell, is very skilled at making various pro-social noises through their smiling mouth holes, but when examined through a somewhat, shall we say, depressive realist lens, don't we see, for the most part, competition, exploitation, usually in the pursuit of our selfish desires, or else indifference and apathy? Every society is three meals away from chaos, is a quote sometimes attributed to Lenin. My version of that would be, every person is just one or two mishaps away from struggling with themselves in a fairly tormented fashion, as well as with their fellow man. But this is the kind of thing you might expect a kind of misanthropist like me to utter, right? I guess what I'm really trying to say is, don't beat yourself up for your hyper-aesthetic valuations, FP. You say an adjective matters more to you than the real weeping of a human soul? I don't think there is a human on this planet where the word adjective couldn't be replaced by something of greater value than so-called empathy. Both you and I know someone, maybe even ourselves, for whom an ideal or a principle matters more than another person's lamentations. Or if it's not that, then replace the word adjective with a noun like success or knowledge or security or pleasure or power or peace of mind, all of which are often valued above affinity, understanding, compassion, and warmth. Paul Bloom, in his book Against Empathy, argues that the E word, which is also often connected to the L word, is a poor guide for moral decision making. Empathy focuses on the illusion or delusion of feeling what others feel, leading us to prioritize helping those who evoke strong emotional responses, which might very well lead us to neglect those who suffer in less emotionally evocative ways. We also, more often than not, feel empathy for someone suffering, but take no steps to help them, recognizing our own lack of agency regarding an intervention beyond that of a momentary feel-good gesture. Nor do we have much empathy for the perpetrators of our own suffering. Are those who have hurt me or you truly villains, or is their cruelty just another form of suffering itself, a twisted echo of the pain that they themselves once endured? I don't think you ever did anything truly heinous in your life, FP, but let's imagine an Eichmann or a King Jong-un, a Putin, a Bashar al-Assad, or even the current leader of Hamas or the Likud party standing on trial for their moral bankruptcies, and no doubt arming themselves against their prosecutors with that piteous or pity-seeking line about not getting enough love as babies to make them good enough people. It's an excellent line, of course, a wonderful psychodynamic line, but it's also, for most of us, sort of Officer Krupke stuff, isn't it?
Hey, you!
Who, me, Officer Krupke?
Yeah, you! Give me one good reason for not dragging you down to the station house, you punk!
Dear kindly Sergeant Krupke, you gotta understand, it's just our bringing up key that gets us out of hand. Our mothers all are junkies, our fathers all are drunks. Golly Moses, naturally we're punks.
Gee, Officer Krupke, we're very upset. We never had the love that every child ought to get. We ain't no delinquents, we're misunderstood. Deep down inside us, there is good.
There is good.
There is good. There is good. There is untapped good. Like inside, the worst of us is good.
That's such a good story.
Let me tell it to the world.
Biographically, we know that your non-fictionalized mother lived until you were in your 30s, although, yes, you did lose a father at an early age, as did I. But you also had a stepfather. Okay, maybe a somewhat surly stepfather, as did I, from the age of 7. So might this account for our arid hearts? I'm not sure it does. I think you come closer to hitting the nail on the head when you talk about your distracted and callous sensibility. We might also use the word character here before seeking out further causal explanations. Perhaps it's not so much about finding a cause, but rather about recognizing the shadowy daemon, as James Hillman would say, whispering in your ear and mine, our sensibility or character, that nihilist or depressive realist who stalks our thoughts and beliefs and sometimes surfaces in our words and actions, perhaps representing a necessary indifference, we might say, a way of protecting our psyche from a world that often feels overwhelming or nonsensical. Is that not why we also self-medicate with drink or cannabis? I know I do. But neither do we have time for the violins, right? You and me. We know when we're being over-mawkish and how off-putting that is for others, one day, including ourselves, when we reflect back on our self-pity. A colleague who works for the NHS texted me the other day about a patient she'd been dealing with that afternoon. Quote, massive cocaine user, pregnant partner, attempted suicide, risk, safeguarding, not the friendliest, kept threatening to put the phone down on me, now waiting for other services to call me back. If I was running mental health policy for the NHS, which it's probably a good thing that I'm not, I text back to her, I would issue Mr. Suicide with the following ontological truth. Your life, Mr. S, is worth far, far less than you believe it to be worth. It is, all said and done, worth less than whatever you paid for the shoes you're wearing on your feet or the trade-in value of your mobile phone. Your death might cause some heartache in the short term for those who have a connection to you, but who's to say whether in the long term you might actually be doing everyone a favor? How's that for distracted and callous? I guess this is also why organized religion has made sure to sanctify the inherent and incontrovertible value of each and every human life, which also acknowledges how our human flaws often lead us to disregard this core moral principle. Of all the seven deadly sins, I think the two that most plague the likes of you and me are, to use their Latin names, acedia, or is it acedia? Acedia, which is to say listlessness, torpor, boredom, apathy, indifference, and invidia, envy, which seems in some way also to be linked to yearning. Many of our letters to each other are impacted by these two characterological flaws, which might also be framed as sinful aspects, because antisocial aspects, of our being. When you say, it's my longing for whom I might have been that distracts and torments me, who would I be now if I'd received the affection that comes from the womb and is placed through kisses on a baby's face, you are expressing a yearning that many of us know all too well, a yearning to belong to another or a group of others, to be loved in some way for ourselves rather than for what we can provide that other person with. A sweet and chimerical fantasy, I think you'll agree. At its core, envy stems from the desire for something we lack, that we feel someone else possesses, some kind of nurturing or affection when young, or some replication of that now in the form of romantic intimacy. Not only do we yearn for this, we also often silently despise the other who has it. This is totally self-destructive because it pits us against those who may seem fortunate in this one aspect that we lack, disregarding all the other aspects we don't lack, and leading us, of course, as we do, to live a life of glass-half-emptyism, even when our bellies are full, our heads sheltered. As for acedia, or acedia, I'm not sure about the pronunciation there, aka spiritual apathy, restlessness, boredom, despondency, hopelessness, social withdrawal, well, no surprise that this would be framed at some point in our human history, circa 400 AD, as a threat to the socio-spiritual order. Framed so in the writings of Evagrius Ponticus, the Christian monk and ascetic, who we can also thank for what we now refer to as those seven cardinal or capital vices. Initially, there were eight sins, or logismoi, as Evagrius called them. The Greek word logismoi might be translated as evil thoughts or suggestions or temptations. All of these, he correctly surmised, with great psychological as well as spiritual acumen, I'm sure you would agree, all of these obstruct, perhaps even distort or divert our path through life. Evagrius's original list is as follows. Greed, sexual immorality, avarice, anger, arrogance, pride, sorrow, and despondency. Because sorrow and despondency overlap, Pope Gregory the Great, who revised Evagrius's original list a couple of centuries later, rendered sadness and listlessness as a single no-no, also combining arrogance with pride, and then adding a final vice to bring the total up to seven, envy. Pope Greg, I imagine, was no stranger to envy, and so had good reason to put this into his Thou Shalt Not list. Being a pope in the 6th century, tasked with converting the then largely pagan Anglo-Saxons to Christianity, was probably somewhat akin to Saint Steve, as in Steve Jobs, introducing the first iPhone into a world of fax machines, pagers, and those deeply unsexy cellular phones sold by Nokia in 2007. Those very weighty and cumbersome candy bar contraptions where each key had to be pressed multiple times in order to spit out the letter required. Saint Greg, no doubt, faced a ton of envy. Wrath, too, probably, from the pagan priests and Anglo-Saxon kings and chieftains living on this island whose spiritual operating system he was set on replacing back in 596. Equally, Saint Steve probably felt a bit of the evil eye directed his way from Olli-Pekka Kalasvuo, CEO of Nokia, in 2006 to 2010. Olli-Pekka, like a captain stuck at sea or a commander clinging to the past, somehow managed to stay at the helm of his sinking company for 3 years after the iPhone's release, still prioritizing hardware innovation over software development, and in so doing, took the company down with him in a pretty brutal and unforeseen manner. Imagine the envy of that guy, you know, towards the black polo neck wearing, faintly monkish Saint Steve and the other preening and pompous unicorn engineers living and working in sunny California in the early aughts. Evagrius is still worth reading on depression, I think, FP. I wouldn't be surprised, actually, if you have read him. Or to use whatever word you prefer for that state, listlessness, weariness, existential boredom, or maybe your favourite word for it, which is, of course, tedium. Here's a passage from Evagrius, translated by Robert Sinkovich a few years ago for the OUP collection of the corpus. Quote, "The eye of the person afflicted with acedia stares at the doors continuously, and his intellect imagines people coming to visit. The door creaks, and he jumps up. He hears a sound, and he leans out the window and does not leave it until he gets stiff from sitting there. When he reads, the one afflicted with acedia yawns a lot and readily drifts off into sleep. He rubs his eyes and stretches his arms, Turning his eyes away from the book, he stares at the wall and again goes back to reading for a while, leafing through the pages. He looks curiously for the end of the text. He counts the folios and calculates the number of gatherings. Later, he closes the book and puts it under his head and falls asleep. But not a very deep sleep, for hunger then rouses his soul and has him show concern for its needs. Andrew Solomon, about 20 years ago, wrote his 700-page Atlas of Depression, which he gave the title The Noonday Demon, using a direct quote from Evagrius, which I think is worth having in full. So here's Evagrius again, writing in his Practicos, a kind of self-help treatise written for his fellow monks. Quote, "The demon of Acedia, also called the Noonday Demon, is the most oppressive of all demons. He attacks us about the fourth hour, 10 a.m., and besieges our souls until the eighth hour, 2 p.m. First of all, he makes it appear that the sun moves slowly or not at all, and that the day seems to be 50 hours long. Then he compels us to look constantly towards the windows, to jump out of our cells, to watch the sun, to see how far it is from the ninth hour, 3 p.m., to look this way and that, lest someone has tried to get in touch. And further, he instills in us a dislike for our place and for our state of life itself, for manual labor and also plants, the idea that love has disappeared from humanity and there is no one to console us." End quote. Evagrius's cure for Acedia is really no different to what a million and one podcasts and YouTube videos espouse we all do in our depressed and anxious day and age. Maintaining a regular schedule, exercise or engaging in manual labor, CBT, which he calls discernment of spirits, in other words, being mindful of the source of one's thoughts and emotions and mitigating as much as possible against these. Also acceptance and patience, gratitude, hope, and community support. I guess if sertraline or fluoxetine were around at the time, he probably would have included those too. Like all of us virtually connected and thus hopelessly alienated 21st century bods, community support is probably what I most lack in my life, which is why I so value the opportunity to wrestle my noonday demons here with you, FP. Although you are in a different time zone to me, and no longer active, we might say, in a corporeal sense, I often feel your spirit, your soul, very, very strongly when I read, as I still do, now and then, the odd fragment from your Book of Disquiet. Much in the way that I feel the presence of my friend Rob, who tunes into this podcast and voice notes or sends his own thoughts back on this or that topic, even though we've never actually communicated with each other in real time and maybe never will. There are so many ways to accompany each other as we head from one kind of non-existence towards another through this weird little tunnel of experience that we call life. I thank you for being with me in this tunnel, my friend. Speak to you soon.